at the Grand Vizier's house for dinner. Only Enver knew of the dramatic events that had just unfolded in the Dardanelles. "Unto us a son is born," he exclaimed with a peculiar smile, to the general confusion of his colleagues. Enver, in many ways the most outspoken advocate of an alliance with Germany, greeted the arrival of the German ships with the same delight he would show the birth of a son. As he briefed his colleagues on the arrival of the Breslau and Goeben, he set out the political problems the empire now confronted. According to the laws of war, the Ottoman government had two options to preserve its neutrality. It could demand the German ships leave Ottoman waters within 24 hours, or it could disarm and intern the German ships in an Ottoman port. There was no question of the Ottomans expelling their German allies' ships from Turkish waters to face certain destruction by the British and French fleets waiting offshore. When the Grand Vizier and his ministers subsequently broached the subject of disarming the ships with the German ambassador, Wangenheim refused outright. The Ottomans then proposed as a compromise solution that the Germans transfer the ships to Turkish ownership through a fictive sale. Before the ambassador could secure Berlin's approval, Cemal Pasha issued an official communique to the press on 11 August announcing the purchase of the Goeben and Breslau by the Ottoman government for 80 million marks, a figure Cemal seemed to have plucked from the air. The German ships would thus replace the dreadnoughts Sultan Osman and Reshadiye requisitioned by the British Navy. The announcement of the sale of the ships to the Ottoman Navy was a public relations coup for both the Young Turks and the bemused German government. Turkish anger against Britain for stealing the warships the Ottoman government had commissioned and paid for was transformed into gratitude to Germany for providing the modern warships the Ottoman Navy needed. But the Young Turks came out of the deal well, too, having trumped the British and French by securing modern warships that gave the Turks mastery over Russia's Black Sea fleet. Ambassador Wangenheim was left to explain the fait accompli to his government in Berlin, as the Breslau and Goeben were renamed Yavuz Sultan Selim and Medili. Admiral Souchon was appointed commander of the Ottoman fleet, and the German sailors were integrated into the Ottoman navy. Best of all, from the Ottoman perspective, the German ships shifted the naval balance of power to the Ottomans' advantage and deepened their ties to Germany without forcing Istanbul to abandon its neutrality in the expanding global conflict. Having weathered the crises of August 1914, the Ottomans were in an advantageous position. They had secured an alliance with a great European power to protect their territory from Russian aggression. They had mobilized their armed forces to make the European powers take note of Turkey. They had acquired the modern warships that shifted the naval balance of power in both the Aegean and the Black Sea to Turkey's advantage. Through it all, Istanbul managed to avoid getting entangled in the spreading war itself. Ideally, the Ottomans would have liked to preserve their neutrality for the duration of the European conflict. This would have left the Central Powers to wear down the Entente armies and allow the Turks to wait until the prospect of an Austro-German victory seemed likely before entering the fray, thus to secure their war aims with least risk or expense in men and materiel. Germany demanded a far more active involvement of its Ottoman allies. From the moment the German ships were transferred to Ottoman ownership, Berlin pressed the Turks to join the war. The only question facing German war planners was how best to use their Ottoman partner in the expanding war effort. Some argued the Turks should open a new front against the Russians to undermine the Russian war effort against the Central Powers. This would free the German army to deploy more of its forces to the Western Front to confront Britain and France. Those closest to the Ottomans understood Istanbul's hesitation to take on the Russians. Since 1711, the Ottoman Empire had lost each of its 7 wars against Russia, and in the immediate aftermath of the Italian and Balkan Wars, it had no confidence of victory against its most dangerous neighbor. Should Turkey attack Russia in 1914 and lose, it knew it faced certain dismemberment. Others argued that Ottoman forces could be used to best effect in a swift attack on British positions in Egypt. If the Ottomans could secure the Suez Canal, they would disrupt British communications with India and cut the supply of men and materiel not just from India, but also from the dominions of Australia and New Zealand. German war planners were under no illusions about the strength of British defences along the canal. However, they believed the Ottomans could deploy a secret weapon to undermine British positions. In addition to his role as Emperor of the Ottoman State, the Sultan held the religious office of Caliph, or leader of the global Muslim community. The Germans wanted to play on the religious enthusiasm of Egypt's 12 million Muslims, as well as the millions of Muslims in British and French colonies in Asia and Africa, to weaken the Entente powers from within their own empires. An attack on Egypt, combined with a declaration of jihad, or Islamic holy war, could provoke an uprising among Egypt's restive population that would make Britain's position in that country untenable, or so the argument ran. John Buchan's popular novel Greenmantle, first published in 1916, captured the European fascination with the latent power of Islamic fanaticism. Islam is a fighting creed, and the mullah still stands in the pulpit with the Quran in one hand and a drawn sword in the other, Sir Walter Bullivant, the spymaster in Buchan's novel, asserted. Supposing there is some Ark of the Covenant which will madden the remotest Muslim peasant with dreams of paradise. Variants of this fictive conversation, which Buchan set in the Foreign Office at the end of 1915, had been taking place for real in government offices in Berlin. They called it Islampolitik, and many Germans believed that the Ottoman Empire's greatest contribution to the war effort would come through Islam politics. The prophet of Germany's Islam politic was Baron Max von Oppenheim. Born to a banking dynasty in 1860, Oppenheim had the personal resources to fund his fascination with the Orient. He made his first trip to the Middle East in 1883 and travelled widely across the region as a scholar and an adventurer. In 1892, he moved to Cairo, which served as his home base for regional travels until 1909. He was a prolific author, and his four-volume classic study of Arabian tribes, Die Beduinen, remains a standard reference today. T. E. Lawrence, later celebrated as Lawrence of Arabia, was one of his readers. Though dismissed by German diplomats for having gone native, Oppenheim gained the trust of Kaiser Wilhelm II, who gave the maverick Orientalists the official title of Legationsrat, Chief Legal Counsel, in 1900. Each summer, when Oppenheim visited Germany, the Kaiser met with him for a briefing on the state of the Muslim world, a part of the world in which Wilhelm took personal interest since his triumphal Ottoman tour of 1898. Deeply hostile to the British Empire, Oppenheim was one of the first to advocate using Germany's budding friendship with the Muslim world as a weapon against it. As early as 1906, Oppenheim predicted, "In the future, Islam will play a much larger role. The striking power and demographic strength of Islamic lands will one day have a great significance for European states." The Baron wanted to harness that strength to Germany's advantage. When war broke out in August 1914, Oppenheim established a jihad bureau in Berlin to produce pan-Islamic propaganda to instigate revolts in French North Africa, Russian Central Asia, and, the jewel in the crown, British India, with its 80 million Muslims. Oppenheim assured the Chancellor that even if the rebellions failed to materialize, the mere threat of a Muslim uprising in India would force England to agree to peace terms favorable to us. Though frequently dismissing this tactic as jihad made in Germany, many overtly secular young Turks also believed that religious fanaticism could be deployed against the Entente. Enver had come to appreciate the power of Islam when he fought in Libya in 1911. Before setting out for Libya, he called for a guerrilla war against the Italians. Once on the ground, he increasingly viewed the conflict in terms of jihad. In his letters, Enver had described the Libyan volunteers as fanatical Muslims who see death before the enemy as a gift from God, and frequently noted their devotion to him as the son-in-law of the Caliph. His colleague Jemal also saw Islam as a bond between Arabs and Turks, and thought a religious war would strengthen those ties. Jamal argued, "The majority of Arabs would not hesitate to make any sacrifice in this great war for the liberation of the Musulman Caliphate." Influential members of the Unionist leadership were thus convinced that jihad, a powerful weapon in the early period of Islam, could be revived to serve as a source of strength in the impending conflict with the European great powers. Whatever hopes the Young Turks had invested in jihad, they remained committed to keeping the Ottoman Empire out of the war for as long as possible. Across the months of August and September 1914, Turkish officials gave their excuses to the increasingly impatient Germans. Mobilization, they argued, remained incomplete. Were the Ottomans to attack Russia before their army was at full strength, they would risk the sort of defeat that would make them more of a liability than an ally to the Central Powers. The Ottomans made clear to the Germans that they still saw Russia as posing an existential threat to their empire. The Young Turks did not disclose to their new allies, however, that in their bid to address the Russian threat, they had even proposed a secret alliance to the Russians themselves, one that would necessarily have led to a rupture with Germany. Enver Pasha, the most outspoken advocate of Turkey's alliance with Germany, first proposed a secret treaty with Russia. On 5 August, just 3 days after concluding the secret agreement with the Germans, Enver stunned the Russian military attaché to Istanbul, General M. N. Leontief, by proposing a defensive alliance with Russia. Grand Vizier Said Halim and Enver's Young Turk colleague Talat Pasha joined the negotiations and drew the Russian ambassador to the port, M. N. Giers, into the discussion. They sought Russian guarantees of Ottoman territorial integrity and the return of the three Aegean islands and Bulgarian-held Western Thrace, lost in the Balkan Wars. In return, the Ottomans would give full military support to the Entente war effort and dismiss all German officers and technicians then at work in the Ottoman Empire. Enver, Talat, and Said Halim succeeded in convincing the Russian ambassador and military attaché of the sincerity of their offer, and the two Russian officials threw their full support behind the proposed alliance with Turkey. The Ottoman ambassador to St. Petersburg, Fakhreddin Bey, pursued the question of a Turco-Russian alliance with the Russian government. He explained to Foreign Minister Sergei Sazonov that the Ottomans sought territorial guarantees and a Russian pledge to withhold support for Armenian nationalist aspirations in eastern Anatolia. Sazonov, however, was unpersuaded by the Young Turks and his own ambassador in Istanbul alike. He refused to abandon the Armenian reform project and put little faith in Enver's promises to break with Germany. Sazonov would concede at most, with the support of Russia's allies Britain and France, an Entente guarantee of Ottoman territorial integrity in return for Ottoman neutrality in the war. Such a guarantee would do nothing to restore Ottoman losses in the Aegean or Thrace, and would not protect the Ottomans from Russian ambitions after the war. The fact that Sazonov upheld the Armenian reform project only reinforced Ottoman fears of future plans for the dismemberment of the empire. The German offer remained the best deal on the table, and by the end of August the Ottomans reverted to their special relationship with the Central Powers. That the Young Turks approached the Russians at all demonstrated the lengths to which they were willing to go in order to stay out of Europe's war. Given the course of hostilities in August and September 1914, the Ottomans had every reason to take caution before entering the conflict. The German war of movement that had led to the swift occupation of Belgium and a rapid advance on Paris ground to a halt in the decisive Battle of the Marne, 5 to 12 September. The belligerents began to dig the trenches that would prove one of the defining features of the static warfare on the Western Front. The other hallmark of the Great War was already apparent by September: unprecedented casualty rates. French dead and wounded exceeded 385,000, and German casualties surpassed 260,000 on the Western Front alone. German forces destroyed an entire Russian army in the Battle of Tannenberg in late August, inflicting 50,000 casualties and taking 90,000 prisoners. The Russians fared much better against the Austrians, who suffered over 320,000 casualties and 100,000 captured in the Galicia campaign. Russian losses were also incredibly heavy in Galicia, with over 200,000 casualties and 40,000 POWs. Austria also launched an unsuccessful attack on Serbia in August 1914, in which Habsburg losses of 24,000 well exceeded those of Serbia, whose population was less than one-tenth the size of Austria-Hungary's. British casualties by November 1914 reached 90,000 dead and wounded, exceeding the total size of the original seven divisions of the British Expeditionary Force. In less than 6 weeks of fighting, the Entente and Central Powers had suffered well over 1 million casualties. It was enough to give the Young Turks pause. German patience with Ottoman procrastination snapped in September 1914. With German forces tied down on the Western Front, and the Austrian army gravely weakened by fighting against both Russia and Serbia, the Central Powers urgently needed the Ottomans to open a new front against the Russians. The Young Turks continued to promise to enter the war while making demands for funds and war materiel. In mid-September, the German Minister of War, General Erich von Falkenhayn, refused to honour any further requests for officers, artillery, and ammunition until the Ottoman Empire was at war with Germany's enemies. As far as Berlin was concerned, the transfer of the Goeben and Breslau gave the Ottoman Navy the perfect instruments to initiate hostilities with Russia and establish naval supremacy in the Black Sea. An attack on Russia would shatter Ottoman neutrality and draw the Turks into Europe's war. At that point, the Sultan could proclaim the jihad on which German war planners placed great hopes of undermining the Entente powers through their Muslim colonies. The challenge for Germany was to force the Ottomans to overcome their hesitation and attack the Russians. A key impediment for the Ottomans was money. They needed substantial funding to maintain their high level of mobilization and enter into military action. In mid-October, Minister of War Enver Pasha came to the negotiating table, offering an immediate naval attack on Russia in return for financial support. Enver also promised to contain the Russians in eastern Anatolia and to mount an attack on British positions in Egypt. In addition, the Sultan would declare a holy war against the Entente powers. The Germans were quick to accept the Ottoman offer and dispatched 2 million Turkish pounds in gold to Istanbul, to be released on the opening of hostilities with Russia. The Germans promised a further £3 million to be dispersed over the next 8 months, after the Ottomans had formally entered the war. This funding gave Ottoman war planners the financial stability with which to prosecute their own ambitious war plans. On 24 October, Minister of Marine Cemal Pasha drew up the fateful orders authorizing Admiral Souchon to conduct manoeuvres in the Black Sea. Enver Pasha gave Souchon a second set of orders, instructing the fleet to attack Russian naval forces. The admiral agreed to keep Enver's orders sealed until instructed by radio to open the envelope and carry out the instructions. Yet the initiative had now slipped from Ottoman hands as the reflagged German ships sailed into the Black Sea on 27 October. Souchon might well have been seconded to the Ottoman navy, but he owed his full loyalty to the Kaiser. When Enver failed to radio Souchon, the German admiral took the initiative and opened hostilities against the Crimean Black Sea fleet on 29 October, sinking a gunboat and a mine-laying vessel. The Goeben also shelled the Russian city of Sevastopol. The following day, the Ottoman government issued a statement condemning a Russian attack on the Turkish fleet. Russia, then Britain and France, recalled their ambassadors from Istanbul before declaring war on 2 November. The Ottoman Empire was at war. All that remained was to raise the banner of jihad. This was not the first time the Ottomans had used religion to mobilize their subjects for war. As recently as 1877, Sultan Abdulhamid II had raised the banner of the Prophet Muhammad to declare jihad against the Russians. Yet the circumstances in 1914 were different. This time, the Sultan would be rallying the Muslims of the Ottoman Empire and the world beyond Ottoman frontiers to wage war on some non-Muslims, Russians, Britons, Frenchmen, Serbs, and Montenegrins, in the first instance, but not on others, namely the Empire's allies, Germany and Austria. A group of 29 Islamic legal scholars met in Istanbul to deliberate and drafted 5 legal opinions, fatwas, or in Turkish, fetvas, authorizing jihad. The 5 fatwas were formally sanctioned by the Sultan and presented to the leading political, military and religious authorities in a closed session on 11 November. Only then, on 14 November, was the call for holy war read out in public to a large crowd gathered outside the mosque of Mehmed the Conqueror in the Sultan's name. The crowd roared its support. The Ottoman authorities could be confident that Arabs and Turks within the empire would respond to the Sultan's call. They would have to wait to see if the jihad would have wider repercussions as the whole world mobilized for war. 3. A global call to arms. In the first week of August 1914, news of war spread around the world at the speed of the telegraph. Drummers and buglers roused martial spirits in towns and the countryside across 5 continents. With their countries bound by secret treaties and mutual defense pacts, it seemed only natural that men in Europe would answer the call. Some did so with jingoistic enthusiasm, others with grave reservations about fighting enemies they had, as yet, no reason to hate. As Britons and Frenchmen volunteered to fight the Germans, governments in London and Paris turned to their empires for assistance. Though they had even less cause for hostility towards the Central Powers, Canadians, Australians, and New Zealanders rallied to the British Crown with no less a sense of duty than any other of King George V's subjects. After all, the men of the White Dominions were settlers who traced their origins back to the British Isles, and the British Crown was their head of state. When called on by their king, Canadians, Australians, and New Zealanders felt duty-bound to serve. The same could not be said of the men of Asia and Africa, colonial subjects of Britain and France who, in the main, resented their foreign rulers. As Britain turned to India and France called up the Army of Africa, war planners had good reason to question the loyalty of their colonies. Germany was actively promoting colonial rebellions against the Entente powers, particularly among Muslims. The majority of the world's 240 million Muslims in 1914 lived under colonial domination, nearly all of them subjects of an Entente power. 100 million under British rule, 20 million in French colonies, and a further 20 million within the Russian Empire. The entry of the Ottoman Empire into the war alongside the Central Powers in November 1914, and the Sultan's call for jihad against Britain, France, and Russia, placed Muslim loyalties towards the Entente very much in doubt. Had the Ottomans succeeded in their appeal to global Islam, they could have tipped the balance to the Central Powers' advantage. As it was, the Ottomans faced a major challenge on their own home front, mobilizing their war-weary society to confront the gravest threat in the empire's 6th-century history. In the aftermath of the wars in Libya and the Balkans, men of military age had been discreetly fleeing the Ottoman Empire to avoid the draft. In 1913, emigration to North and South America increased by 70% over previous years. American consular officials claimed that most emigrants were young men evading military service. War rumors in the first half of 1914 accelerated emigration of young Muslim, Christian, and Jewish men from across the empire, until, with the order for general mobilization, the Ottoman government prohibited men of military age from leaving the country. On 1 August, the Ministry of War dispatched Enver Pasha's call to arms by telegraph across the empire. Village headmen and leaders of town quarters posted notices in public squares and on mosque doors. "Mobilization has been declared," the posters trumpeted. "All eligible men to arms. All men, Muslims and non-Muslims alike, aged 21 to 45, were given 5 days to report to the nearest recruiting office. Local officials were told to encourage martial enthusiasm by beating drums, showing joy and gladness, and not despair and neglect. No amount of drum-beating or official displays of joy could overcome the foreboding among Arab villagers when mobilization was first announced. A Shiite Muslim cleric in the southern Lebanese village of Nabatea captured the public dismay in his diary on 3 August 1914. The people were deeply troubled and agitated by the news of general mobilization. They gathered in small groups in public spaces, astonished and bewildered, as if confronting the day of judgment. Some wanted to flee, but where could they go? Others wanted to escape, but there was no way out. Then we heard that war had broken out between Germany and Austria on one side, and the Allies on the other side. This only increased the fear and alarm of the outbreak of a murderous war that would devour the cultivated lands and the dry earth. Similar reactions were recorded across the Ottoman Empire. Shops closed in Aleppo on 3 August in response to the mobilization orders. As one resident noted, great uneasiness prevails throughout this city. In the Black Sea port of Trabzon, the American consul recorded, "The decree of general mobilization came like a thunderbolt." Though anyone evading conscription faced the death penalty, many young men preferred to take their chances and go into hiding, rather than face what they believed to be a more certain death fighting with the Ottoman army. In the imperial capital, Istanbul, the call to arms was announced in each quarter by the town crier, popularly known as Bekci Baba. In daytime, Bekci Baba delivered water to urban neighborhoods. At night, he served as watchman over the streets of the quarter. It was Bekci Baba who sounded the alarm when fire broke out, and it was Bekci Baba who summoned men for war. Irfan Orga remembered how his father was called to war by Bekci Baba. The mobilization that had started in the summer of 1914 accelerated after the Ottoman entry into the war, with ever older men being called up. Orga went outside into the November cold with his father to hear the crier's announcement, and watched as Bekci Baba rounded the corner and stopped beneath the street lamp to shout his shattering news. Men born between 1880 and 1885 must report to the recruiting center within the next 48 hours. Who fails to do so will be prosecuted. One of the men of the household shouted out, "What does it mean, Bekci Baba?" "War! War! Don't you know your country is at war?" he roared. The capital's recruitment centers, flooded with men of military age, were in a state of confusion. Harassed officials bellowed instructions to civilians who were herded like cattle, hungry, hopeless, and apathetic. It could take days for conscripts to be processed for service. Once assigned to their units, men were allowed to return home to collect their possessions and say goodbye to their families. In each district of the city, a noisy band went house to house to collect the young men departing for war. A soldier would hand the Ottoman flag to the new recruit as he came out of his house, while others leaped and shouted along with the band's music to drown out the women's tears. Yet the soldiers departing for war had their own lament. "When they were leaving their homes, the band played a song of unbelievable sadness," Orga recalled, "and everyone started to sing, 'O warriors, yet again I must set out as a lonely stranger. My sighs and tears are too much for even the mountains and stones to bear.'" In this way, house by house, the Ottomans expanded their standing army from 200,000 to nearly 500,000 men and officers before the outbreak of hostilities in November 1914. In the course of the war, some 2.8 million Ottoman men would serve under arms, about 12% of the total population of 23 million, though the Ottoman army never exceeded a maximum of 800,000 men at any one time. The figures for the other Central Powers and the Entente forces dwarfed the Ottoman numbers. Austria called up 3.5 million men in 1914, yet was chronically under strength. In the course of the war, Germany mobilized some 13.2 million men, or 85% of the male population aged 17 to 50. Russia managed to recruit between 14 and 15.5 million men. France raised 8.4 million men, nearly 500,000 of them from the colonies, and Great Britain mobilized over 5.4 million men for the Army and Royal Navy, one-third the pre-war male labour force. Little wonder that the European powers put so little store by Ottoman military might. The rapid expansion of its armed forces placed the Ottoman government under tremendous financial strain. The economic disruptions of mobilization were devastating. Men active in agriculture, trade, and industry were forced to leave their jobs to join the army, reducing productive manpower to a drain on government resources as once tax-paying workers became soldiers on government pay, requiring room and board. The closure of the Dardanelles and the wartime threat to shipping brought the ports to a standstill. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers and the transport of supplies for the war effort clogged the roads and railways essential to domestic and international trade, producing shortages of food and consumer goods. Inflation set in at once, and the threat of hunger hung over Ottoman cities as nervous citizens began to hoard. These disruptions to the Ottoman economy led to a major reduction in economic productivity and thus in government revenues. By contemporary estimates, revenues fell from $63.2 million in the last 6 months of 1913 to $50.2 million in the last 6 months of 1914, a drop of 20%. With spending so far outstripping income, the Ottomans faced a budget deficit that consular officials predicted would exceed $100 million in 1914, basically wiping out in one stroke the benefits of the French loan of May 1914. International confidence in the Ottoman economy was already low before the country went on a war footing. No sooner had the Ottomans announced the mobilization of their troops than European banks began to recall loans made to local financial institutions. In trade cities in the Arab and Turkish provinces, Parisian bankers demanded immediate repayment in gold of outstanding loans in the first week of August 1914. The sudden drain of bullion caused panic in commercial circles across the empire. Depositors made a rush on Ottoman banks to try to recover their holdings. In Istanbul alone, banks paid out over $9 million to depositors in the month of August. To prevent capital flight, on 3 August, the central government introduced a moratorium on banking transactions, initially for 1 month, but extended quarterly until the end of the war. Under the moratorium, debtors had to repay only 25% of their obligations, and banks allowed account holders to withdraw no more than 5% of their deposits each month. These measures relieved pressure on borrowers, but totally paralyzed the banking system and the economy as a whole. Banks would make loans only to the government. In commercial centres like Aleppo, Beirut, Harput, Izmir and Istanbul, the moratorium led to the closure of practically all businesses and industries, according to American consular officials in those cities. The Ottomans turned to their allies in Germany for financial assistance with their war effort. In return for the Ottoman entry into the war, Germany had pledged £2 million in gold and a further £3 million to be paid in instalments over the 8 months following the Ottoman entry into the war. These grants helped restore Ottoman reserves and allowed the government to print paper money secured against gold. Germany also provided up to an estimated £29 million in military materiel and assistance, including essential arms and ammunition, during the war. The Ottoman treasury resorted to extraordinary wartime measures to raise government revenues to offset the cost of the war. On 9 September, the Ottoman Empire declared its economic independence from the European powers by unilaterally abrogating the capitulations, one of the port's original war aims. The measure provoked condemnation in European capitals and widespread celebration among members of the Ottoman general public, who decorated their homes and shops with flags and banners to celebrate their government's getting won over on the Western powers. The abolition of the capitulations was the first tangible benefit of the European conflict for Turkey, and 9 September was declared a national holiday. In Edirne, Istanbul and Kutaya, crowds swelled public squares in patriotic demonstrations. Once the capitulations had been abolished, the Ottomans passed a law with effect from 1 October 1914 to tax not just foreign residents and businesses in Turkey, but thousands of Ottoman citizens who had secured tax-free status as protégés of Western powers. This measure reportedly raised several $1 million for the Ottoman treasury. Requisition was another form of extraordinary taxation, applicable to Ottoman subjects and foreigners alike. The law required the government to offer fair compensation for all property claimed by the state, though in practice the government fixed prices and offered receipts rather than payment in cash. Owners could assume that they had lost anything requisitioned. Ottoman subjects were forced to deliver their horses, livestock, and crops as mounts and food for the army. Officials burst into shops to requisition on the spot those food products and commodities they believed useful to the war effort. Requisitioning could be used as a form of extortion, as shopkeepers were ordered to deliver goods they did not possess, and thus had to buy from government suppliers at set prices. Foreign businesses in the Ottoman Empire also suffered significant losses due to requisitioning. In Syria, a local governor seized Singer sewing machines as a contribution to the provincial regiment's uniform factory. In Adana and Baghdad, governors requisitioned hundreds of cases of kerosene from the Standard Oil Company. Consular officials estimated the Ottoman government raised over $50 million through requisitioning in the first 6 months of mobilization. Ottoman citizens remained the main target of new tax levies. Christians and Jews, subject to conscription but not fully trusted by Ottoman Muslims as soldiers, were given the option of paying an exorbitant fee of 43 Turkish pounds, $189.20, to be exempted from military service. In April 1915, the government raised the exemption fee to 50 pounds, $220. This tax netted the treasury an estimated $12 million in the 9 months following mobilization. The government also introduced new taxes on popular but non-essential consumer goods like sugar, coffee, tea, cigarettes, and alcoholic beverages that were raised from time to time over the course of the war. The government increased agricultural tithes from 10 to 12.5%. Pre-existing taxes were increased by as much as 70% for war purposes, and voluntary contributions were squeezed from individuals and businesses for patriotic and military aid organizations. These extraordinary taxes raised tens of millions of dollars for the Ottoman war effort in the short term, while irreparably damaging the Ottoman economy in the longer run. In 1914, however, the Ottomans were only concerned with the very short term. Like all of the belligerents at the outset of the conflict, they expected a quick and decisive outcome. If victorious, they would have the means to set the economy right. If defeated, they faced the certainty of partition, and the occupying powers would inherit the land's economic woes. The Ottomans could have had no illusions about the life and death struggle ahead, and they threw everything they had into securing victory. As the Ottomans mobilized their troops in early August 1914, the British and French called on their empires to assist in the war effort. In response to the French call, soldiers from Senegal, Madagascar, and Indochina boarded ships for the Western Front, though the largest contingent of all was the Armée d'Afrique, Army of Africa. First dispatched for service on the Western Front, colonial soldiers from North Africa would later serve on the Ottoman Front, in the trenches on both sides. The Army of Africa comprised the colonial regiments of Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. Mobilization in a colonial context was particularly delicate. The French had to persuade the men of North Africa to make war on Germany, a country with which they had no grievance, in defense of an empire that had reduced them to second-class citizens in their own homelands. The task was made all the more difficult by German propaganda and the Ottoman Declaration of Jihad, which played on Islamic loyalties to turn the Muslims of North Africa against the French. The first colonial regiments in North Africa were founded in Algeria in the early 19th century. The colorful Zouave light infantry, named for the Berber Zouave tribe, captured the world's imagination with their dashing uniforms of baggy red trousers, blue tunics, and red chechias, or fezes. In Europe and America in the mid-19th century, elite Zouave regiments of Western soldiers dressed in exotic kit were created on the Algerian model. Both the Union and Confederate armies in the American Civil War fielded such Zouave units. In the course of the 19th century, French recruits increasingly replaced native Algerians in the Zouaves until they were an all-European force. By the 20th century, there were 5 Zouave regiments in Algeria and 1 in Tunisia. Other European units in the Army of Africa included the Chasseurs d'Afrique, a cavalry corps, and the famous French Foreign Legion. Arab and Berber soldiers, excluded from the Zouaves, were recruited to native army units. The Algerian and Tunisian tirailleurs, or riflemen, popularly known as the Turcos, and the Spahi cavalry. While the soldiers in these units were nearly all natives, their officers were almost exclusively French. Algerians could only reach the rank of lieutenant, and could account for no more than half the total lieutenants at any time, though in practice Algerians never reached parity with French lieutenants. The French enjoyed preeminence over Algerians of equal rank. Given the colonial context and the limits the French placed on native soldiers, it is remarkable that Arab and Berber men enlisted at all. One Algerian veteran's experiences suggest that the army was viewed as a steady job in an economy that provided very limited opportunities for working men. Mustafa Tabti, an Arab tribesman from the hinterlands of Oran with no formal education, signed up for the Algerian Rifles in 1892 when only 16 years old, driven by curiosity and the wish to play with gunpowder. When he concluded his first term of duty, he returned to civilian life as a small grocer. He struggled for 17 years between shopkeeping and agricultural work before re-enlisting at the age of 37 as a corporal in the 2nd Algerian Rifles. With tensions building in Europe in the early 1910s, the French began to recruit aggressively in North Africa, offering enticing bonuses and pay packages to Arabs and Berbers. In addition to food, shelter, and a regular salary, the army gave a man a certain position in society, enjoyed by neither a small grocer nor a sharecropper. Until the 1910s, the Army of Africa was entirely volunteer, recruited from the European and indigenous communities of Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. Faced with pressure to expand its military, the French government decided in 1912 to introduce conscription to North Africa. Many in Paris and Algiers had opposed this measure, fearing it would lead native Algerians either to revolt, or worse, to demand equal citizenship rights with Frenchmen as the price for serving in a conscript army. For once, the military planners overcame the objections of the colonial lobby and put in place the mechanics for a draft. The decree of 3 February 1912 limited the number of conscripts to just 2,400 men, chosen by lottery. To ensure the support of Muslim notables, the French ensured a right of replacement, by which more affluent Algerians might pay a fee to exempt their sons from military service. The right of replacement made the draft all the more objectionable to Algerians of modest means, who rose in protest against its introduction. "We would rather die than let our children be taken away," Algerian families protested. Yet the draft lottery proceeded regularly each year after 1912, despite popular protest. On the eve of war in 1914, of 29,000 Algerian soldiers in French service, 3,900 were conscripts. When news of Germany's declaration of war on France reached Algeria on 3 August 1914, patriotic Frenchmen flooded the streets of Algiers in a mass display of patriotism. They sang the Marseillaise and the Chant du Départ, another French Revolutionary-era war song with the refrain, "The Republic is calling us, let us vanquish or perish. For her, the Republic, a Frenchman must live. For her, a Frenchman must die." The French in Algeria adapted the final line to implicate native Algerians in this vision of sacrifice. "For her, a Frenchman must die. For her, an Arab must die." Sharing in a moment of enthusiasm, Messali Hadj, a native of Tlemcen, noted how, musically speaking, all of these patriotic tunes stirred Arab Algerians profoundly. Germany fired its first shots against France when the battlecruisers Breslau and Goeben attacked the ports of Philippeville and Bern, Skikda and Annaba in independent Algeria. Shortly before dawn on 4 August, the Breslau, flying the British ensign, fired 140 rounds into the centre of Bern, hitting port facilities, the railway station, some of the main streets of the city, and a steamship in the harbour. A man named André Gallion was killed, the first French casualty of the Great War. An hour later, the Goeben appeared off the coast of Philippeville under the Russian flag and fired 20 shells into the town, striking the railway station, the barracks, and a gas plant, and killing a further 16 people. Both ships then withdrew from the North African coast and made their way, pursued by the British and French fleets, into Ottoman waters, where they played a key role in Turkey's entry into the war. No reason was given for the attacks, though it was widely believed the Germans were trying to disrupt the movement of troops from North Africa to France, and hoped to undermine Algerian confidence in the French. The German attacks provoked widespread outrage and encouraged Europeans and native Algerians to volunteer for the army. The outbreak of the war coincided with the holy month of Ramadan, when Muslims fast from sunrise to sunset, so the recruitment of native Muslims began in earnest only towards the end of August, when the month of fasting had ended. Recruiting teams of French and Arab soldiers made the rounds in the towns and villages of Algeria on market days. They paraded through public places to the rhythm of drummers and the shrill piping of the gaita, a double-reed horn. The rhythmic music and colourful uniforms always attracted a crowd, but the recruiting officers focused on unemployed workers and peasants. The sergeant major brought the music to an end once it had achieved the desired effect, Masali Hajj recalled. An Arab sergeant would take the floor and elaborate with great eloquence all of the benefits that volunteers would enjoy. His propositions were most attractive, particularly to those with empty stomachs. Their parents, on the other hand, lived in anguish at the prospect of losing their sons to foreign wars. The worst fears of many North African parents were realized within weeks. The Army of Africa suffered heavy casualties almost immediately after the start of the war. Corporal Mustafa Tubti, who had re-enlisted in 1913, was among the first sent into battle in France. He captured his experiences in verse, recorded by an Algerian army translator while Tubti was recovering from wounds in hospital. Composed shortly after the events of September 1914, Tubti's poem gained wide circulation among North African soldiers on the Western Front. He would have been one of the very first poets of the Great War. Tubti crossed the Mediterranean from the western Algerian port of Oran to Sète, where the Algerian rifles disembarked and continued their journey towards the battlefield by rail. Tubti celebrated the bravura with which the Algerians viewed the prospect of battle. "Men," we thought to ourselves, "no fear. Let's show our pluck. Here is our pleasure. We Arabs are made of magnanimity and gunpowder." The North African troops were dispatched to the Belgian frontier, where they first saw battle in Charleroi on 21 August. Nothing had prepared the North African poet for the violence of the battle that followed. "Listen to my story, friends. What an atrocious day for us at Charleroi, my brothers. With cannon and a torrential rain of bullets, they shattered us from mid-afternoon prayer time, Osser, to sunset prayers, Maghrib." As the battle wore on over the following days, the casualties on both sides mounted. "The dead lay in countless piles," Tubti recalled. "They laid the Muslim beside the non-believer in a common grave. Artillery fired from afar set aflame earth and stone alike, my lords. We perished in great numbers by bayonets and bullets that buzzed from all sides. Leaving us no respite, they followed our tracks over 6 consecutive days, my lords. They charged us with the impetuosity of a torrent, my lords. In Belgium, they give no respite." The French and their North African forces managed to inflict losses on the Germans before retreating. "We shattered them," Tubti boasted. "Wherever you direct your step, you encounter a burial ground filled by them," that is, the Germans. Yet the memory of the North African dead, from Oran, Tunis, Morocco and the Sahara, weighed heavily on the Algerian war poet. "The sight of so many young men mowed down has melted my heart. My lords, dead, these heroes remain in the solitude of the countryside. They perished without anyone reciting the profession of faith for them, lords. They lay exposed to the wild beasts, eagles, and birds of prey. In their memory I sing with sadness, lords. Were you made of stone, you would spill tears for them. The Battle of Charleroi proved a futile butchery that decimated the ranks of North African regiments alongside those of the regular French army. Battalions of 1,200 infantrymen were cut down to less than 500 in a single day's fighting. Initial casualty rates among the Turcos ran to 60% dead and wounded. As experienced soldiers fell, they were replaced by raw recruits with inadequate training, who panicked under the blistering fire and suffered yet higher casualty rates. When the French retreated from Charleroi to regroup for the defence of Paris, the North African soldiers were redeployed to the Marne, where they played a key role in halting German advances, though again they suffered terrible casualties. In all, some 6,500 North African soldiers died between August and December 1914 alone, and thousands more were wounded. Inevitably, word of the massive losses on the Western Front trickled back to North Africa. Such terrible casualties fed rumours that North African soldiers were being used as cannon fodder to spare French soldiers from the worst of the fighting. Spontaneous protests against recruitment and conscription broke out across rural Algeria in September and October 1914. Families refused to deliver sons called up for conscription, and bans set on recruitment teams in the open countryside to release volunteers before they reached the barracks. The uprisings served as a reminder to the French of the trouble that a religious uprising inspired by the Ottoman declaration of jihad might produce. Faced with nationwide resistance, the authorities had to divert 1,600 soldiers from European battlefields to Algeria to restore order. Several soldiers were captured by the insurgents and murdered before the army regained control and resumed the recruitment of fresh troops for the Western Front. Despite local resistance, the recruitment gangs proved effective. In the course of the war, over 300,000 North Africans, 180,000 Algerians, 80,000 Tunisians, and 40,000 Moroccans served in the French army on both the Western and the Ottoman fronts. The British also called on their empire to contribute troops to the war effort. When Britain declared war on Germany on 4 August 1914, three of its dominions, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, followed suit that very same day. Each country began to mobilize its soldiers for war, imagining they would be defending Britain in the European theatre. The overwhelming majority of Canadians did serve on the Western Front, aside from a handful who served on riverboats in the Mesopotamia campaign or with medical units in Salonika. Yet most of the volunteers from Australia and New Zealand first saw service on the Ottoman Front. They mobilized at the same time as Turks, Arabs, and North Africans, global soldiers who turned Europe's conflict into a world war. On the opposite side of the globe from the theatre of conflict, Australia and New Zealand responded to the outbreak of war in Europe with no less a sense of duty to the empire than any Briton. In Australia, the leader of the opposition Labour Party, Andrew Fisher, captured the spirit of the moment when he pledged his country's support to the last man and last shilling. Early in August 1914, the Commonwealth of Australia mobilised the Australian Imperial Force, and the Dominion of New Zealand called up the New Zealand Expeditionary Force. Their combined forces came to be known as the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, the celebrated ANZACs. Both Australia and New Zealand had sent contingents to support Britain in the Boer War, 1899 to 1902. But this first experience of fighting foreign wars in no way prepared the men of the Antipodes for the violence of the Great War. Of 16,000 Australians sent to South Africa, only 251 were killed in action. More soldiers, 267 men in total, died of disease. New Zealand experienced similar casualty rates. Of 6,500 soldiers, 70 were killed in action, 23 died accidental deaths, and 133 perished from disease. Drawing on the recent memory of the Boer War, Kiwis and Aussies volunteered in great numbers, looking for adventure and foreign travel, imagining no doubt that nearly all would return crowned with glory. The Australian and New Zealander contingents comprised both cavalry and infantry. Most volunteers for the cavalry were from rural areas and came with their own horses, some of the more than 16 million horses to be caught up in the Great War. Cavalry volunteers had the option of enlisting with their own mounts and received £30 for the horse if it passed muster. The horse then came under army ownership and was branded with a government insignia and a number burnt into its hoof. A military horse, known to cavalrymen as a remount, had to fit strict criteria. It must be a gelding or mare, aged 4 to 7, well-muscled, no taller than 15.2 hands, of sound disposition, and calm under fire. The Australian New South Waler fit the bill perfectly, a hybrid of thoroughbred and draft horse stock. The men of the New Zealand Expeditionary Force came from all parts of the country and all kinds of backgrounds. They were farmers and mechanics, shepherds and bushmen, clerks and teachers, stockbrokers and bankers. They joined because all of their friends joined. For some, war held the prospect of a big adventure. Others volunteered out of patriotism towards Britain and the British Empire. None had the slightest idea where they would end up fighting, but after 6 weeks of training, they were ready to go. Trevor Holmden, a young lawyer from Auckland, remembered how he and his fellows marched from their training camp on One Tree Hill down to the transport ships in the harbour. Auckland turned out en masse to see us go, and although most people were glad to get rid of the last hooligan element we were thought to include, we all thought we were heroes, and I think bore ourselves as such. Personally, I took great pleasure and pride in the march, and the whole affair was certainly very dramatic and martial, when, with bands playing and flags flying, we passed from the world we knew through the great iron gates that shut off the Queen's Wharf, and so on to the ships which were to carry us God knows where. Given the relatively small size of their populations, Australia and New Zealand could contribute a limited number of troops to the war. Australia had a population of 5 million, and New Zealand only 1 million in 1914. Only Australian men aged 18 to 35, and New Zealanders aged 21 to 40, who stood 5 feet 6 inches or taller and were in good health, were eligible for service. By the end of August, the Australians had raised a force of 19,500 men, 17,400 infantry and 2,100 cavalry, commanded by nearly 900 officers. In addition to a small campaign force of 1,400 men dispatched to occupy German Samoa, the main body of the New Zealand Expeditionary Force, comprising nearly 8,600 men and over 3,800 horses, was assembled in less than 3 weeks. The troop transport ships were delayed by reports of a German naval squadron believed to be operating in the South Pacific. Though the volunteers had completed training by late September, the 10 transport ships only set off from Wellington on 16 October, escorted by a Japanese warship and 2 British vessels. Frank Holmden found himself on the Waimana, along with 1,500 men and 600 horses, packed like sardines. They sailed for Australia, where they joined forces with the Australian Imperial Force and, on 1 November, sailed from Hobart in southwestern Australia, their destination still unknown. Only after the Anzac convoy was underway did the Ottoman Empire enter the Great War on 2 November. Rather than sail on to Britain, the men of Australia and New Zealand would disembark in Egypt to fight on a Middle Eastern front. As the British and French drew their empires into the European War, they were forced to examine the loyalties of the Muslim subjects under their rule. The Algerians had long-standing grievances with the status quo, which denied citizens' rights to native Arabs and Berbers. Indian Muslims were restive after decades of declining influence in the British administration, and increasingly declared allegiance to the Ottoman Sultan in his role as caliph of the global Muslim community. 3 decades of British occupation had given rise to a nationalist movement in Egypt, whose bid for independence had been frustrated at every turn. Some feared, with good reason, that colonial policies had so alienated Muslims in India and North Africa that they might side with the enemies of Britain and France in the hope of securing independence through a German victory. As the crossroads of the British Empire, Egypt was crucial to the war effort. The Suez Canal was Britain's vital communications link to India, Australia, and New Zealand. Egypt's military bases served as both a training ground for imperial troops and a staging post for operations in the Middle East. Were Egyptian nationalists to take advantage of the war in Europe, or pious Muslims to respond to the declaration of jihad and rise in rebellion, the consequences for Britain's overall war effort would be disastrous. When war broke out in Europe in August 1914, the government of Egypt had already adjourned for the summer months. The Khedive, Abbas II Hilmi, was in Istanbul on holiday, and the Legislative Assembly was in recess. The Prime Minister, Hussein Rushdi Pasha, was forced to make decisions during a rapidly evolving crisis without conferring with his head of state. On 5 August, the British pressured Rushdi Pasha into signing a document that essentially committed Egypt to a declaration of war against the king's enemies. Far from securing Egyptian loyalty for Britain's war effort, news of the decree antagonized the Egyptian people. The deep-seated distrust, common to all classes of the population towards the occupying power, that is, Britain, expanded into a sentiment of bitter, if silent, hatred, a British officer then serving in Egypt recalled. Through an involuntary and despised association with Great Britain, Egypt had been dragged into a struggle, of which the origin was obscure to her and the objectives unknown. Between August and October, British censors shielded the Egyptian public from the worst reports from the front. The news from Istanbul was also subject to British censorship, until the Ottomans entered the war on 2 November 1914. Though under British occupation and de facto administration since 1882, Egypt was still legally part of the Ottoman Empire, and had been since 1517. The Khedive was an Ottoman viceroy, appointed by the Ottoman Sultan and paid an annual tribute to the Ottoman treasury. As Germany's ally, the Ottomans were now the enemies of the British crown. Egypt was thus caught in the contradictory position of being a loyal Ottoman vassal state and, in line with the 5 August decree, a country at war with the Ottomans at Britain's behest. Britain's position was hardly less complicated. The Ottoman entry into the war meant that Britain occupied enemy territory, and that the 13 million residents of Egypt were now hostile aliens. On the same day the Ottomans entered the war, the British declared martial law in Egypt. There was no public reaction, but the British authorities remained concerned about Egyptian loyalties. Unwilling to involve Egyptian soldiers in a fight where bonds of religion would almost certainly outweigh respect for the colonial authorities, the British decided to exempt the Egyptian people from the war entirely. On 6 November, the military commander in Egypt, General Sir John Maxwell, made the following pledge. Recognizing the respect and veneration with which the Sultan is regarded by the Mohammedans of Egypt, Great Britain takes upon herself the sole burden of the present war without calling upon the Egyptian people for aid therein. Veteran Egyptian politician Ahmed Shafik claimed that Maxwell's announcement rocked public opinion in Egypt, ever mistrustful of British intentions after more than 3 decades of occupation. While pledging to spare the Egyptian people from any involvement in the war, the British imposed strict restrictions on impeding the work of their forces in Egypt or providing succour to Ottoman efforts. Moreover, the British would soon find they could not keep their promise to take on the burden of the war without Egyptian assistance. Egyptian soldiers would serve in the defence of the Suez Canal, and Egyptian workers would, in due course, be recruited to labour gangs on both the Western and the Middle Eastern fronts of the Great War. Although Britain had secured public order, it had yet to resolve the legal contradictions entailed by its position in Egypt. On 18 December, Britain unilaterally decreed Egypt's secession from the Ottoman Empire as a British protectorate, bringing to a close 397 years of Turkish rule. The following day, the British deposed the ruling Khedive, who was deemed too sympathetic to the Ottoman cause, and installed the eldest living prince of the Egyptian ruling family, Hussein Kamil, in his place. Now that Egypt was no longer a vassal state, the British gave its ruler the title Sultan, a titular promotion that flattered Egypt's new ruler by putting him on an equal footing with the Ottoman Sultan. With a compliant new ruler who owed his position to the imperial power, the British were free to concentrate on securing Egypt, and the Suez Canal in particular, from Ottoman attack. While many of the British soldiers in Egypt had already been sent to serve on the Western Front, reinforcements were soon to arrive in Egypt from Australia, New Zealand, and India. India, under Crown rule since 1858, was the centerpiece of the British Empire. The Raj was headed by a British viceroy who ruled over some 175 princely states that gave allegiance to the Crown as their suzerain. With its own civil service and army, India was a state within the British imperial state. One quarter of India's 255 million inhabitants were Muslims, over 65 million in all. German intelligence had identified the disgruntled Muslims of India as the Achilles heel of the British Empire, and hoped to use the Ottoman call for jihad to provoke uprisings that would destabilize the Raj and speed Britain's defeat on the Western Front. On the outbreak of war in 1914, Britain had two imperatives in South Asia: to recruit as many Indian soldiers to the war effort as possible, and to preserve the loyalty of Indian Muslims against Ottoman and German jihad propaganda. To advance both aims, George V, the British King Emperor, issued a proclamation to the Princes and People of India on 4 August. He explained Britain's reasons for declaring war on Germany and called for India's support for the imperial war effort. Much to the British government's relief, the Indian ruling elite responded to the King's appeal with effusive declarations of loyalty. The loyalty of the Indian Muslims to the King Emperor, the Aga Khan asserted, is proof against any attempt of German diplomacy in the Near East or elsewhere to create a bastard pan-Islamic sentiment in favour of the mailed fist made in Germany. Muslim princes across India repeated his views in public statements. The Ottoman entry into the war and the Sultan's declaration of jihad threatened to bring disorder to the Raj. Popular loyalties were divided between the Sultan, Caliph, and the King Emperor. To ensure the support of Indian Muslims, King George V gave assurances that Britain and its allies would protect Mecca and Medina, the holy cities of Arabia, the Red Sea port of Jeddah, and the shrine cities of Mesopotamia from attack. The King's pledge helped preserve Indian Muslim support for the British war effort. Yet, as with their promise to spare Egyptians the burden of the war, the British would find that their pledge to shield the Hejaz from the dangers of the conflict would come under pressure. Following the King's declaration about the Muslim holy sites, Indian Muslim notables proved effusive in their support of the British war effort. The Nawabs of Bhopal, Ranpur, Murshidabad and Dhaka, along with the Nizam of Hyderabad, all affirmed that the Sultan had misled Muslims with his erroneous call to jihad and insisted that Indian Muslims had a duty to support Great Britain. The Aga Khan went so far as to withdraw his recognition of the Ottoman claim to caliphate. Now that Turkey has so disastrously shown herself a tool in German hands, she has not only ruined herself, but has lost her position as trustee of Islam, and evil will overtake her. The Council of the All India Muslim League passed a resolution in November 1914 asserting the participation of Turkey in the present war had no impact on the loyalty and devotion of Indian Muslims to the British Empire. The Council affirmed its confidence that no Muslim in India will swerve even to a hair's breadth from his paramount duty to his sovereign, the King Emperor. Similar resolutions were passed by mass meetings of Muslim notables across India in November 1914. Muslim loyalty confirmed, Britain turned next to mobilizing Indian troops for the war. India responded to George V's call with more volunteers for the war effort than all other colonies and dominions combined. Between 1914 and the end of 1919, some 950,000 Indians signed up for military service, and another 450,000 served as non-combatants, for a total of 1.4 million men sent abroad to participate in the war effort as soldiers, workers, medics, and other auxiliaries. Soldiers of the Indian Army fought on every front of the war, over 130,000 on the Western Front alone. Yet their greatest contribution to the British war effort came in the Middle East, where nearly 80%